Hello, students. To refresh your memory a little bit, we were discussing autism, and we went, among others, through characteristics of autistic disorder, and that the diagnosis is made on the basis of three criteria. This was the first one: qualitative impairments in social interactions. And we have discussed a little bit some characteristics belonging to the first criterion. The point we were making was that there are three criteria. There are many symptoms connected to criterion one, to criterion two, to criterion three, and that in order to receive the diagnosis, and you can read it here, a total of six or more items from criterion one, two, and three are needed. Well, that means that many people can, let's say, fulfill the requirements of receiving the diagnosis, but that the characteristics of the persons might vary in a huge way. So how to interpret the research findings when so many people with, let's say, different characteristics are joining the group of autistic individuals, and their performance or their brain indices are different from the controls. But when you take this into consideration, then you can imagine that much of the research is contradictory, because the people who are joining the experiments are small, and we talk about a heterogeneous population. If you think that this only is the matter with autistic disorder, then you are wrong. That is not the case. Also, with respect to ADHD, there are many people with totally different symptomatologies. And if you also take then the comorbidities into consideration, that people have more than one disorder, you can imagine how complicated it is to interpret the research findings. Then we were talking about adults, that it is really from the last, maybe 10 years, that the research is slowly and slowly also including adults with autism. And it will take a few years, and then also researchers will investigate, let's say, dementia in autism. It is simply a matter of focusing on the fact that people become older. And so it started with children, and now we are also investigating adults, and in the near future, I think also elderly. We were also talking about the fact that we have a diagnosis, so you can fulfill the criteria. But at the same time, there are many people who don't fulfill the criteria of a disorder, in this case, autism, but nevertheless can become quite close to it. And we were talking about a person, let's say an engineer, who is working in the south of the Netherlands in the Philips factories, and we were discussing all kinds of characteristics of that person. So he is not fulfilling all the requirements, but comes close to it. And the end conclusion was, what a pity that many people who are not fulfilling the criteria, they are participating in this society, that they may experienced a burnt out because of all kinds of characteristics I have discussed with you, burnt out, and that the problem is hardly recognized in the field of, let's say, those who become unemployed when they are getting older. So a lot of teaching has to be taking place, I would say, in the near future to inform physicians, psychologists about all these things we have discussed. Also, when it comes to marriage, it could lead on the long run to a lot of trouble and divorce and things like that. We have discussed that now. Here you can see the incidents, how often it takes place, and the idea is there an increase in prevalence? I think that for years I used those question marks, but now I think it is time to say that yes, there is an increase in prevalence. And for instance, girls, women were not diagnosed, but were, let's say, underestimated in getting the diagnosis. The same holds for ADHD, by the way. And why is that? Probably because the diagnosis, the characteristics are mainly based on male behavior. So one of the reasons that there is an increase in prevalence is the acceptance, is the recognition of the fact that there are girls who are now missing to be diagnosed, and if you change a little bit the diagnostic criteria in favor of also, let's say, typically female behavior, then it will lead to an increase. But there are also other theories, like the pollution, that in some areas in the world, that increase may be partly, it is not totally caused, but maybe partly caused by environmental factors. And pollution is one of them. And a few years ago, I know that there was a huge meeting of experts concerning autism, a symposium, and was taking place, and one of the speakers came from America, from one of those big cities, and he or she, I can't remember whether it was a male or a female, showed data in which it was at least plausible that pollution might be a factor. So all in all, we talk about autism deficits, autism disorder, without knowing the exact mechanism. So research is, of course, needed to understand the mechanisms producing autism. But having that said, at the same time, it is quite sure that genetically mediated factors are involved in the ontogenesis of the disorder. So we don't know it, but there are ideas, and some ideas will be discussed, of course, during this lecture. On one day, there was some research published. I think it was Danish research, in which a connection was suggested between rubella vaccines and autism. And the world of people with autism, they were shocked to read it. And
that finding, it needed replication, but it was never replicated. So the outcome of one single study resulted in a lot of worries in people with autism or in the families raising children with autism because of this assumed connection, rubella vaccines and autism. And once again, there is no single reason to believe that this is really the case. But it shows, of course, the worries people have about the offspring with autism, because it can be a quite severe issue. And some people can't live independent. So we in Holland, we have our institutes meant for, let's say, children and adults who can't remain at home. There are, of course, many theories of autism spectrum disorder. And one essential issue is a theory explaining the symptoms, or is it describing the system? Sometimes it is quite confusing because many so-called theories are in fact describing the disorder. When it comes to explaining, that is of course a different level. Well, I think that practically everybody, also the layman, they have heard about the theory of mind. And here you can read one of those definitions concerning the theory of mind: understanding, mental and emotional states of oneself and others. So, understanding. But what is meant by understanding? Cognitive understanding? Or that you can share your understanding with others? You can show that. People, students who have followed my course about biology and autism, and I was discussing all kinds of behavioral studies in monkeys and also in people with autism. The main result of those observational studies was that when we talk about cognitive understanding, then many people with autism are able to cognitively understand mental and emotional states of oneself and others. But when it comes of sharing, that could be the problem. I don't want to repeat that course, but for those of you who haven't followed that course, it is of importance to differentiate between, let's say, the more cognitive component of this word and the more emotional connotation of this word. Anyhow, standing in the shoes of others, that could also be a nice way to express what is meant by a theory of mind. And talking about that example, we have invented earlier, also this day, about that person who is working. So he is participating in the society, but he has a problem, let's say, with the theory of mind, which means that he can't lie, he can't manipulate people. And these are high skills in people around us who don't have autism. It's a matter of manipulation, it's a matter of lying, etc., etc. When we talk about the theory of mind, understanding emotional state of oneself, then please also include the physiological state. I already have said it earlier, but of course you have forgotten it. What to think about problems with toileting? Yeah, that when children have reached a certain age, they can go to the toilet themselves and they can go to the toilet in time because they can, let's say, understand the signals produced by the body that it is really now time to go to the toilet. Well, about 30% of the children with autism, they hardly understand those signals, and that produces a lot of problems with toileting, yeah? So problems at home, problems at school with it, and part of those treatment programs are then focused on toileting in those people. Theory of mind. Then we have the central coherence theory. That means that you are able to give a speech with a red line in it. It's logic, it's step by step, and you are not focusing to a certain extent a small detail. Yeah? But people with autism, they, not all of course, but many, have a weak central coherence. It means that they are blowing up unimportant issues, and as a result of that, the whole logic of their story is disappearing. Central coherence theory. So global processing, that is of course a gift, that you can say, we are not too detailed, because then also the story becomes too complicated. No, it is global and you go step by step. Then we have an executive function deficit, impaired cognitive control. Well, we have talked this over with respect to ADHD, and it must be said that many people with ADHD, they also show signs of autism and vice versa. In the past, it was so that this overlap was ignored because people who are working in the field, the clinical field, they considered it more of importance to notice the level of autism in children, and they thought, well, that ADHD symptomatology, that is not so much of importance. Nowadays, things are different, and also in the clinical field, clinicians become very keen on identifying, if needed, the amount of ADHD symptoms in people with autism. Then there is a theory of extreme male brain theory. And Baron Cohen from England, he is one of the persons who have developed this theory. And the idea is that in the fetal stage, too much testosterone is going into, let's say, the system of the unborn child, and that may lead to an extreme male brain. And that also, when we return to here, understanding mental and emotional states, that of course I'm now using a proto prototype, but the idea is a little bit that male are as such not so good in understanding mental and emotional states of others. Yeah, that is a little bit a stereotype, but anyhow, it is connected with the extreme male brain theory. One way to test it is to a very simple one. You have your right hand, and you have here your finger, this finger, and then the difference between this finger and the middle finger is little, too little, then it could be a way of the expression of an extreme male brain. There is not so much research on this, which is, let's say, validating this theory. It is an idea, but interesting enough to mention. Then we have a very important theory. And that theory considers autism to be part of the natural variation. So it means that we as humans, we vary in the color of our hairs, the color of our eyes. Some people are tall, other people are, let's say, smaller. Mention it. Some people are have the tendency to become fatter than others. So we all have, of course, variations. And we also have variations in personality. Some people are kind, some people are this, and etc., etc. But when autism belongs to the natural variation, then at best, you may say, okay, people with autism, and especially people with high functioning autism, they are different. And a difference doesn't mean an abnormality. Yeah, think about it. When are things becoming an abnormality? On the one hand, you can say, okay, we have a normal distribution. It goes like this. It is a normal distribution. And 5% of the people, they are so showing high scores on this trait and that trait that I consider it abnormal. That is, in a sense, a statistical way of looking at normality and abnormality. You can also say abnormality means that people are asking for help. They don't feel good. They don't feel happy, because then it is the happiness alone which is the central element in talking about normal and abnormal. But let's say that you hardly can survive in this complex society. But that is, of course, when people are getting older, not to be the idea you can have about yourself. So put in other words, it could be possible that a child received the diagnosis of high-functioning autism. That person becomes older, an adult, and then he, at a certain day, is saying, I feel okay. I don't feel that I am a patient. I am maybe different than the norm, but I am not in a situation that I am in need of help. And this theory of natural variation, this is really a theory that is upcoming. There are adults with autism, and they say, I am proud. to be autistic. I am different, but I am not crazy, so to speak. And they want to be also involved in research. And when you are, let's say, a more modern research group, then it is not out of the question that also some of the people who are joining that research group are, let's say, people who have the diagnosis, but they want to be involved. They say, without our involvement, we don't want to get things published. We are belonging to people who are different and not abnormal. Well, you can find this theory quite easy when you are interested in the ins and outs. It also could be the case that the person itself says, well, I am normal, but that people in the surroundings, for instance, the parents, that they have still the idea that this is not the case. So you can also a little bit invent what kind of discussions in the households are taking place when a child with autism has reached a certain age. This could also be the case, by the way, by ADHD. And when you are giving children a diagnosis, it could be that the child is growing out of the disorder. That could happen at least with ADHD. When it comes to autism, then I would say there are no studies available showing that as a function of age, people are growing out of the symptomatology. I can't say that, but people can develop a different view on their own. Anyhow, natural variation theory, it belongs to this. And what they say is people with that diagnosis, they need to participate in our society. And then we have, of course, biological theories. And they are focused on the connectivity of the neurons in close connection to the genes. So here we have theories, and there are, of course, more, but these are maybe the most important ones. Let's talk about the theory of mind. So the first and maybe most important theory. What are the empirical findings? Well, that is a good question. When you are writing your manuscript, you can state that the theory of mind is an important theory simply because you find it in all the textbooks. But what about the empirical findings? And half an hour ago, we were already talking about a weak part of all the research, so also including research considering the theory of mind, because of the amount of people who are joining that research. Anyhow, when we talk about this area, then about 350 publications showed up, which is not that much when we have to compare it, by the way, with ADHD, because then we talk about, well, I would say 10 thousands of articles. The person who wrote a very good review article, and it was published in a developmental review, it is the man is from the Netherlands, Sander Begeer, and that is the journal in 2008, and he differentiated emotional competence in three different parts. Expression, detection, and understanding. Expression. Let's start with this. Well, so what Sander Begeer did in his study, he went through those articles, and the statement is that in general, expression is comparable to the norm, and especially in those in adults and those with a normal IQ. So once again, when you go through the literature, you have to take care about what you have done with the IQ level. Are we including people with a lower IQ, or do you have reasons to focus on people with autism having an IQ in the normal range? I mean, that matters. And there are, of course, you can choose to say, well, I am not so interested in the whole domain of autism. I limit myself to people with a normal IQ simply because of the heterogeneity of the disorder and the individual differences. And you must also take care of the fact, are we talking about adults or are we talking about children? I mean, it is nice when you write a paper that you talk about adults and children, but you also make it yourself quite complicated. You can better choose for adults or for children, or that you are, let's say, interested in the differences between adults and children, or that you are interested in the symptomatology in people with a low IQ in comparison with the normal IQ. And so you must, of course, compose your story on the basis of logic. Anyhow, when we talk about expression, then it seems that it is comparable to the norm. If we take this into consideration, these matter, but it is less spontaneous. And it is also less as a reaction to others. So here you still see that the interactions, the social, emotional interactions with others might be compromised when the expressions are less as a reaction to others. So, for instance, you start to cry, and the other person is seeing it, and he may indeed give a cognitive signal in the sense of, I understand your emotion. Oh, you feel pain, but you say it in a way that you can hardly feel that the person is, let's say, sharing that feeling with you. Because that sharing is, of course, based on the matter of spontaneity. And that it is a reaction to, I mean, what you have to say or what you have to see. But all in all, when it comes to the expression part of autism, then at least in this review, it seems to be comparable to the norm. And here we have detection of emotions. And what you see here are pictures of faces, also here, of actors. So those actors, their behavior, their facial behavior, has
as filmed.
And the actors were reading, well, you have to make this type of feeling, or this type of feeling. This is sad, I would say. And this is very surprised. Yeah? So these are faces of actors. And here you can see a line. And also here. And also here. And here you can read the autistic group. So what you see here are the eye movements made by people with autism. And here the eye movements made by the control group for with respect to detection. So the people with autism, they had to decide what kind of emotional expression they see here, and they see here, they see here. But here you see the way they look at the picture. And that is, of course, quite strange if you have to compare it with the way the control group is looking at the face. Then you see here the mouth, and they look at the eyes and the eyebrows, the nose, and that is here the same. And that is also the same here. So when it comes to detection of emotions, you can say, well, they may have problems in detection of emotions. And that could be the case due to the fact that they are not, they, people with autistic traits, they are not detecting the faces well here and here. And those who have followed my biological course, they know that when we talk about face recognition, that all what concerned was this triangle. Do you remember? The eyes. And that it was in very young individuals genetically triggered, this ability after birth. Yeah? Do you remember? And this is exactly what you see back. That also in children or in adults, a basic ability to recognize faces, to recognize emotions, is, let's say, a little bit or very much compromised in people with autism. And it might be explained by means of a very special gene population. Do you remember? Which becomes operational before birth. It has to do with shaping the networks and things like that. And it is expected. Now here you see it back. This is another example. This is a very good movie. Who is Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I really recommend you to see that movie once. And here we have a couple. And you can read from their faces that that couple is shocked. Look to his eyes and her eyes. And I can tell you why. Because there is a man coming into the room, and he is assuming that he has a gun. And that man was hosting that couple, so they didn't expect that. And they are shocked. And here again we see how a person with autism is looking towards this picture. Not to the signal. No, it is to a certain part. And here we have the control. And the control is, of course, focusing on the signal. people are shocked, are afraid. So taking together, you could explain this in, well, detection of emotions, strange detection, at least in this study. And that could be the reason why people with autism, and that is a characteristic of them, they hardly can remember faces, yeah? But you can also say they don't go to the signal, they are swimming, so to speak, in the details. Yeah, they are, it could be the hair. Well, if you are only looking at the hair of a person, then you don't remember the face. So that is a little bit what is going on. What do the detection findings suggest? They are less oriented on emotions of others. So they have show signs of indifference. And when you show signs of indifference, then it becomes clear that you are not the most popular person in life. When it comes to your friends, you hardly have friends. And here again, you see that people are less spontaneous. And here we have the complex word of understanding. And I already said to you, understanding has a cognitive connotation, but also a feeling connotation, sharing. And you know, when people have a normal IQ and they are, let's say, older than 10 years of age, then the majority is able to recognize emotions. They are able to understand elementary causal relations and the context of emotions. So when there is an ability to understand causal relation, it is something that you can't understand the context of the emotions, but it could be too rational. I have said it already a few times. But when the emotions become more complex, then even when it comes to the cognitive part of understanding, it seems that people with autism might have some problems with that. And again, it is the whole skill is correlated with IQ. Well, you have now been listening for 45 minutes. My idea is to stop 7 minutes or something like that, and then we continue. Thank you very much.
So maybe it's time to continue. All in all, talking about the theory of mind, and there are all kinds of tests, mind reading tests. So people are asked to sit in front of a computer. Faces are projected on the screen, and then decisions have to be made. What kind of emotions do I see? The SALI test, that is one of the first tests ever developed in the field of autism. Then detecting emotions from faces. Well, we have discussed this. Exploring the face of another person. Telling what another person feels. So then you must think about that the child has a booklet in front of him. And then the first picture shows a boy biking. And the second picture shows the same boy, and he is falling with his bike on the floor. And then the third picture, well, in a sense, the children have to make a decision between, let's say, a child who is crying or a child who looks happy. And then, of course, the picture showing a crying face is more probable. And then they have to make decisions which picture belongs to the feeling of the child who was falling down. But when you control for IQ, then there are small, if any, differences are left compared to the norm. And this hopefully reminds you to one of my remarks made earlier, that many times small samples are joining the experimentation, and given the heterogeneity of the disorder, then it might be simply a chance level that differences are found. And so some studies will report small differences, others no differences, and well, you could write a paper about this issue. Who found differences, who didn't find differences, and then the important question concerns, why is that? Also, motivation is involved. So there is some research showing that without reward, people with autism show worse performance on a test. But as soon as motivation is involved, for instance, the children receive money or a toy or whatsoever, then the performance improves. And we mustn't forget that autism does not mean without emotions. They have emotions. Whether they show their emotions, that's another thing. But anyhow, you can't say that it means that no emotions are involved. They are, let's say, different. And here we have the cognitive theories. For instance, that central coherence theory. Once again, it means that there is a preference of details. There is less preference for, let's say, the real signal. We have discussed this central coherence theory. So it means that the global processing is impaired. People with autism have the tendency to focus on details and then losing the red line of the discussion. But also here, the results are inconclusive. So it means some studies find differences, other don't find differences, and
that also could be,
yeah, the theme of a good paper. And then we have that executive function theory. We also did research on the executive function theory, and that was carried out by Hans Bochte, which was in those days one PhD student of mine, and we will discuss those study outcome in the next slides. Well, we have already discussed the error processing. Do you remember what happens when people are making errors? And the idea is, and I repeat myself, that when we have here a task, a reaction time task, and here we have correct responses, so the mean is, for instance, 500 milliseconds, those reactions are close to each other, and then an error shows up. And as I have explained earlier, an error is most of the time faster than the correct responses. So this is much faster. And what happens after error making, and we call that in jargon the RTE plus one, a correct response followed an error. So are people aware of the error making? And if that is the case, then they will be much slower compared to the correct responses, which are here produced in a chain. And we found already that in people with cerebral palsy, with that motor disorder, those people were very aware, very keen of when they had made an error, that in the next trial they corrected themselves and they became slower. In people with ADHD, we also have discussed that. They hardly become slower after error making. It seems that they remain to react like here. So they are maybe aware of the error making, but they don't come to a solution to slow down their reaction times later in order to avoid errors. Let's see what happens with people with autism. Well, here we have then the profile in adults, controls, and adults with high functioning autism. And then you can see that there is a straight line. Those people are avoiding errors, in the sense, by being very slow. So that is a unique, I would say, problem in those people with autism, that they hardly are making errors. They avoid errors, probably by checking and rechecking and rechecking their performance. Whereas the controls, here we have the errors. Errors are fast, and then they become slower, because here we have correct responses, and here they become even more slow after they made an error, RTE plus one. And that is, that profile is absent in adults with autism. Yeah. Here we have a study where we were using the fast and the slow presentation rate of stimuli in a Go
no-go test. And let's repeat ourselves. We have discussed the profile of people with ADHD. That was, they need stimulation that is provided during the fast event rate. Do you remember? They need stimulation. They are here in a so-called optimal state. And when the presentation rate is slow, the task becomes boring. They are not allocating enough energy to maintain this optimal task performance. Look, there are no differences with the control group, for instance. And as a result, they become more and more slow. So people with ADHD are not able to regulate their state. Here it is optimal, here it is not optimal. You can regulate it by lifting your activation state. They don't do that. And as a result, they make a lot of errors. And we have discussed that earlier, when we were talking about ADHD. But here, we have the people with autism. When the presentation rate is fast, they make a lot of errors. And here, during the slow presentation rate, their performance becomes like the controls. So the performance normalizes during the slow presentation rate. So in terms of the state regulation model, people with autism are, let's say, easily overactivated. That happens in the fast event rate. And when the event rate slows down, they become more activated, normally activated. So here they are overactivated, and here they are, let's say, in an optimal state, and they perform like the controls here. So there is maybe then a double dissociation, that is the jargon, between two different problems. ADHD, which is the problem of underactivation. And people with high functioning autism, they might be overactivated. And as a result, here we find the errors, and here the performance normalizes. The activation state normalizes. So a double dissociation with a question mark. Well, I have written this down with a question mark because in other research using children, we didn't find this effect. We found this effect in adults, not in children. So the results are a little bit contradicting, and you can read here that study. Reimakers was one of my PhD students, and she published in the Journal of Clinical and Experimental Neuropsychology that there were no differences between people with ADHD and autism, and even with controls on this type of the test. So this holds for adults, and in children the situation could be different. Why is that? Well, one of the interpretations is that adults with high-functioning autism, that they were more severely afflicted than the children who took place in this experiment. Because many of those children who took part in this study were, belonging to the PDD-NOS types, which means that the children were not fulfilling all the requirements, and here older people were in fact fulfilling the requirements. Anyhow, more research is needed in this field, and there is so far very little research in this field focused on development. So we can only hypothesize why there were differences in one study and not in another one. Here we have the concept of automatization. What does it mean? It means that there is a lot of training. This is the first training of a cognitive task. And then another training, and here we have again training. And here we see people with ADHD and controls, and we see that as a function of training, the performance becomes faster, and also the variation of their performance becomes less, and they are making less errors when the training proceeds. It means that when the training starts, the participants were, let's say, in a controlled mode of information processing. It means that all the energy is devoted to the task. You could compare it with learning how to type. That when you are sitting in front of a type machine, then of course you make errors, you are slow, you can't do a second task at the same time, you can't talk with other people. But as a function of training, let's say secretaries, they became so automatized in these cognitive steps needed for typing that they can even have a short, simple conversation with other people. So, as a function of training, controls and people with ADHD, they jump from controlled processing into automatic processing. The people with autism don't do that here. It is a straight line. And here we have the performance of the controls. They become, of course, faster and faster, less and less errors, but not the people with autism. The performance remains the same. Why is that? It's a matter of interpretation, but you could say they are avoiding errors. Because what is going on when you are getting more and more automatized, that when at a certain moment the context of the task is changing, so new stimuli are suddenly presented, then you have to jump into controlled processing. And because you didn't expect this to happen, you are going to make errors. So getting automatized has a benefit. But when there is a change in the environment, then you have to jump, and then you can make errors. So automatization also has the tendency that it may lead to more errors, where you have to change your style, your performance style. And as I said earlier, people with autism, they try to avoid errors. Then this is the way to do it, not to becoming automatized. And here is the final example of the studies carried out by Hans Bochten concerning error making. And here we are talking about a pre-setting study. So here we have a probability that you have to give a yes response or a no response of equal proportions, 50%. So you are forced to remain in a controlled mode system. You have to take care. It's effortful because you can't predict whether the next response must be a yes response or a no response. And here, we were using the same task. The probability of a no response increased to 70%. So here, the system is, let's say, making predictions about the future trials, and you become faster when you have to produce a no response. Here you can see it. It becomes faster. No responses become faster. Here we have two groups of people with autism. Here we are dealing with the outpatients. So they were not that severely autistic, so they could live on their own. And they are also presetting in favor of a no response, you see. They are not normalizing, but they, you see, it is at least coming closer to the norm. And also people with autism here are a little bit presetting, but it is only a little bit, and they remain much slower in comparison to the other two groups. And these are the inpatients. So people who are, let's say, severely autistic, and they couldn't live on their own. No, they are living in clinics. And so they are more severely disordered than this group, and you can see they don't preset. Well, the same story with the probability of error making is taking place, because the more you preset in favor of a no response, the more chance you make an error when a yes response is required. When you remain slower, then that probability of making an error is less pronounced. So all in all those four studies, when it comes to error processing, they are slow and remain slow. My interpretation is they remain in a controlled mode processing time after time, which is very effortful, but they are preventing errors. The same holds here. When the event rate gets lowering down, then the task at hand becomes also more doable. For people with autism, you are making less errors. And here we have the same with respect to automatization and with respect to presetting. So all in all, we could say that the outcome of these four studies shows that people with autism remain in the controlled mode processing in order to avoid errors. That makes them very reliable when it comes to participating in the society, when it comes to doing certain jobs. I told you earlier, I am the chief of the Dutch Scientific Journal of Autism, and once I was asked by a few people who were starting an enterprise. They were all having the diagnosis of autism. And they said, may we advertise in your journal? We are checking software programs, which is, of course, very boring. And I said, of course, you may do it. It doesn't cost money and for you. And I wish you all the luck. Because they can carry out jobs without making errors. Well, that makes them very reliable with respect to carrying out certain jobs. And I told you earlier, they are very loyal to the company. And they are very careful in doing things. And they make then their living out of, if I may say so, their handicap. Yeah, because they are so detailed, they are very equipped for certain research. It also means that when you are the whole day in a so-called controlled processing mode, then you are very tired when you come at home. And that is what many people with autism and also the peers, the friends are saying. So they are slower, and there is a tendency to remain in a controlled, effortful information processing modus, checking and rechecking, avoiding error making. So when this is really true, then we have to reconsider all kinds of cognitive research. What kind of tests are used? And what kind of independent variables are used? Speed? Errors? Is it so that when you are limit yourself to tasks which only have a speed factor, then for sure the conclusion of the research will be people with autism have an executive function deficit. But when it comes to errors, then maybe, especially when you are controlling for IQ, then the errors are very little in this group, but they are slower. And only when you are slower, you can avoid errors. So you see that the cognitive research, well, it is not a closed book, so to speak. Then we have other theories like the extreme male brain theory. We have discussed that, and that there is only, when I was doing some research, there was only one study in favor of the extreme male brain theory, and that it was only the case in women with autism. Now, we also have discussed the natural variation theory. You can also call it neurodiversity theory. And it is closely related to high-functioning autism. And indeed, there is no clear-cut off gap between diagnostic levels of autistic traits. We have discussed that earlier. It is a normal distribution, and you put somewhere the boundary, and here are some, is at least one study who is discussing the natural variation theory, but nowadays there is much more to say about this issue. Once again, people are different according to the theory. They have a different way of information processing. Well, we have discussed that, but you can't say that it is, let's say, belonging to an abnormal way of carrying out these tests. Now we are arrived at the biological studies, for instance, on emotions. And I just give you a few examples of studies that has been carried out so far. Here you have an actor again. And here there are different ways of entering the room, and the people with autism and the control group, they have to watch those pictures. And here this is the neutral condition. Here a fearful condition. So probably the participants have a couple of buttons in front of them, and they have to choose, is it fearful or other kinds of feelings. Here you see the sequence, fearful, fear status, etc., etc. And at the same time, for instance, functional fMRI, and then it might lead to differences at some spots. Here we have the group of people with autism, and here the so-called control group, we also call it typical group. And then what researchers are doing is measuring those areas. Is it larger or is it smaller? Here you see that there is activation. Here there is no activation in this part of the brain. Now you can plot it, of course, here. Differences, no differences. But remind, when we talk about these studies, it only consists of small amount of cases who have to compare in this study emotional versus neutral conditions. If you write a paper on this tool, then for sure some studies will find differences, other don't. Also, take notice to the fact that this is a little bit an old way of viewing the brain working, because here we don't talk about networks so far. Huh? We talk about target locations, and then the target locations are compared. Nowadays, the network approach, which is more popular, and we also will end this talk with the network approach. Well, this is another example. Is the person angry or happy? And then some group comparisons are made showing that the controls having more activation than, for instance, than the people with autism. All in all, when we talk about the biological research, then there are no biological markers available so far. So the diagnosis is made on behavioral symptoms. We have already talked this over when we were discussing ADHD. There is a huge inconsistency in findings due to the heterogeneity of the population in relation with little sample size. At best, research outcomes suggest abnormal brain growth in early life, followed by reduced growth. What have you learned about the brain development as such? Do you remember that when fetuses have reached the age of 5 months, and they have still 4 months to go, that practically all the cells are there. Now what happens afterwards is the differentiation, that the cells are making connections by means of axons, by means of dendrites, by means of lowering the synaptic thresholds. We have discussed that in a nutshell. So we know that when it comes to early life, that there is brain growth. But it seems to be that it is abnormal, and then followed by reduced growth. Let us go to the last pictures here. We have abnormal brain growth. I already said that. There is especially increase in white matter. Do you remember the myelination, that white matter around the axons in order to improve the signal-to-noise ratio when it comes to electrical activity? So this is what you can see here with respect to what is the difference between a normal brain, and this is the brain of a person with autism, that when you take into consideration the volume of all these nuclei that especially the white matter is overrepresented in the brain of a person with autism compared to what is taking place here. So it is white matter. This is another representation. Here we have people with autism, and here we have radiate white matter, bridging white matter, and then you can see that in when it comes to the radiate white matter, that especially the people with autism have higher volumes when it comes to white matter in comparison to a group of people with learning disabilities. And it holds for the prefrontal cortex, the frontal lobe, the temporal lobe, now even the occipital lobe a little bit, and here the parietal lobe. Yeah? So there are here two examples showing that especially the white matter is overrepresented in people with autism. So that is then called abnormal, in the sense that more than in the controls, and it concerns, and that is what you have learned, connectivity. And it is not out of the question that especially the short connections are overrepresented. So many, many short connections and the long distance connections in the brain are reduced. So that could explain the, for instance, the inability to look to the global issue. No, when you have excessive short connections, then you are, of course, very much detailed. I can show you that here. This is a formal picture. So when you have to identify a color, then there are minimal associations. So this is just what I invented. And when it is a more complex issue you have to do, then also areas in the brain which have longer connections might be compromised in people with autism. Here we see the same. This is an easy task, so then you see only connections here. And here the task becomes more complicated. You see more connections. And here we have a very complex task, a conceptual knowledge task, with so many areas in the brain are needed in order to give a response. So this goes from easy to complex. And you see that complex means that you also need then highways, so to speak, at a larger distance. And this is then, I would say, the state of the art at the moment. Here we see all kinds of connections, and we call this the effective connectivity modeling. And then there are a few highways, white, with a white color, white material, which are identical between the controls and the people with autism. We can even have stronger highways in people with autism. And it also could be possible that there are no highways presented at all. And here you see then some numbers. And that is an index of the connectivity between certain layers, certain nuclei of stimuli. Well, this is what the biological theory has to offer, that strong weak connections and the low distance connections are less pronounced in the people with autism. As a final word, when it comes to treatment, no pharmacological intervention is possible at the moment, which doesn't mean that people with autism don't use medication, but then we are talking about comorbid problems like anxiety disorder or depression or epilepsy. And the learning skills are difficult to extrapolate to other situations. What do I mean by that? Well, suppose that there is a child with autism and he goes 20 times to seek intervention. And during that intervention, his manners are taken into consideration. So the child learns to say hello to a person he has never seen before. He is shaking hands. He is starting to use two words, not only yes and no, but yes, madam, no, madam, and things like that. So suppose that the intervention is focused on social skills as part of the theory of mind. And indeed, after 20 sessions, the child has improved in those skills. Now, the caretaker is very happy and goes very proudly with the child at home, and they have to take the bus. So they are waiting in front of the bus stop, and at a certain moment the bus is stopping, and the chauffeur is saying, "You can get in." And then the child of 10 years is saying to him, "How do you do, sir? My name is etc., etc." And he is then giving a hand to that chauffeur. Well, that means then that although at the hospital the social skills improved simply because it is a repeating and repeating of the same skills, but in real life there is no or hardly an extrapolation to other situations, because saying hello to a chauffeur is okay, but shaking hands and introducing yourself to you is a little bit too much. See you tomorrow again. I have put two new files to Elisa, and I think that she has already sent them to you, and we start with epilepsy tomorrow. See you hopefully tomorrow. Bye-bye.
The new files have been uploaded under the presentation folder in Moodle.